Central Time. I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a legal expert breaks down the federal indictments against former President Trump after his first court appearance today in Miami. First, summer is music festival season in Wisconsin, and there's a lot to see and hear. But it can be overwhelming finding the right festival for you and knowing how to prepare for a day of music in the outdoors. Good news, our next guest has lots of advice for festival first-timers and longtime fans. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What Wisconsin festivals are you looking forward to this summer? What advice do you have for first-time festival goers? What questions do you have if you want to check out a festival but don't know where to start? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Piet Levy is a music reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Piet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, is Wisconsin back in the festival groove after COVID disruptions over the years?
Yeah, it's definitely the most normal it's been in many years. I mean, as you recall, everything was canceled in 2020. 2021, a few things came back. Summerfest that year, which is the biggest festival in the state, came back in September of that year. And by then, cases were up, and there were a lot of protocols at the gates. Those protocols were dropped for 2022, but still last year you had some festivals that didn't quite get back up to speed. I think this year it's definitely full throttle, to the point that we're seeing maybe some new events we don't typically see, like the Harley-Davidson Homecoming Festival, which is the first big Harley-run music festival in Milwaukee in a decade. But that's happening this summer.
And before we check out more of the music and the festivals themselves, can you give us some basics, Piet, for people who think, okay, I want to check out a music festival, but I don't know, I've never been to one of these before. Some preparation, what kind of things do they want to do before they head out to the festival that day?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I think one thing I've noticed in a lot of concert reviews coming out of the pandemic is that there's been more issues of fans kind of, I think, getting overwhelmed or getting dehydrated, feeling a little sick or fainting, things like that. I've seen that definitely at more shows, and that can definitely happen at festivals. Artists, too, are kind of more cognizant of that, and I think fans in general are more cognizant in trying to alert artists or alert security when there's an issue. But I do think that what we're seeing is people are kind of coming back, they're super excited, or maybe they haven't done these kinds of things in a while or ever at all, and they're kind of pushing their body past the limit, but not really understanding that. So I think it's really important that, especially a festival on a really hot day, for instance, stay hydrated, you know, just try to take some good rests, try to get some shade when you can, but definitely push the water and make sure that you can, you know, you stay healthy and stay safe out there. I mean, that's kind of like the main absolute rule, I would say. And beyond that, I mean, there's, you know, I think you should be prepared for parking and be prepared for transportation issues. I know that it's definitely been a challenge, you know, getting to festivals with just, again, coming back from things. It just seems like sometimes the driving can just be a lot longer to get a parking spot. So I think you just need to be planning accordingly, give yourself plenty of extra time to get to a festival, to get through security, and just take good care of yourself. Don't push yourself too hard. Don't push it too late in terms of getting out the door.
This is Wisconsin summer, so weather is always predictably unpredictable. How about being prepared for all the elements that Wisconsin summer has to offer?
Yeah, I mean, I think if it's you know, check the weather. If it's going to be hot, definitely stay hydrated, stay cool. You know, find ways to, you know, get a mister or something like that, or take some breaks kind of in the shade. If it's raining, just kind of plan accordingly with a poncho, or you know, make sure you know maybe you see a show if it's a covered stage. I know there's some of those at Summerfest. You kind of plan to see stuff there if need be. I think in terms of shoes, especially if you're like really walking around. I mean, I learned this the hard way covering a festival, you know, in the early years, where I wore sandals for a very intensive walking, you know, festival that took a lot of walking. And by the end of the night, my feet were just totally just screaming at me. So I think just make sure you have like really appropriate sturdy footwear. I think sneakers are probably gonna be best for you, honestly. Just a lot of good foot support with that. And yeah, I think just stay hydrated, stay cool. There's been times in the beginning, especially when I was starting out, kind of where I just wore, you know, jeans, but it was just a really hot day and it was just like killing me, or yeah, not having the right kind of shoes. Or definitely, I know there's been a couple festivals where I just did not drink enough water, did not get enough shade. I did not apply sunblock every 90 minutes. And then it just felt so much worse by the end of the day or the next day. So just make sure you take care of yourself. It's exciting, obviously, but take care of yourself.
We're getting some musical and practical advice for Wisconsin's summer music festival season. Piet Levy is with us, music reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite music festival in the state, what do you like about it? Do you have some advice to share for first-timers? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dan is with us in the Dells. Dan, hi.
Hi there. Yes, I'd like to talk about the Wajawa End of Summer Festival. That's the second weekend after Labor Day. Every year, same weekend. They have Maxwell Street Days. They have a craft mall. They've got every local social club, the Elks, the Lions, the Polish, at every intersection, cooking authentic food. There's bands at night. The swing crew plays at the showboat. And then on Sunday has one of the best parades, about two and a half hours long. It has every local band in it. It has the dancing grannies in it from Waukesha. It is truly one of the best festivals in Wisconsin.
Dan, thanks a lot for the recommendation. That's Wozhawa, W-O-Z-H-A-Wa Days Fall Festival. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Piet, we're looking at a lot of the higher profile events today, but people can find some music and all the other fix-ins at a lot of local events too around the state.
Oh, there's way too many to cover. I mean, it's insane how much there is, but that's what makes Wisconsin so special in the summer. I mean, obviously winters can be pretty treacherous and unpleasant at times. But in the summer, I mean, that's really when the state truly shines. And you've got, yeah, huge festivals, but you've also got, with the big names, then you've got a lot of really wonderful, fun, charming, probably less stressful, less costly, you know, street festivals or festivals in smaller towns. And festivals that also stretch, you know, they're not just in the dog days of summer and August, but you do have festivals like we just mentioned out in through September, sometimes October. So, I mean, there's just a ton of great options. So there's so much to look for. It just kind of depends on what you want to do, when you're available, and where you want to be.
Let's start naming some more names now. You wrote a piece, Piet, on some of the festivals you look forward to. One of them is Appleton's A Mile of Music. This is a unique thing here in Wisconsin. Tell us a little bit about that for people who haven't been there.
Yeah, the Mile of Music is really unlike any other festival in the state and unlike many others in the country. It's celebrating its 10th year this year. And the way this works is that there's a mile-long stretch of basically businesses in downtown Appleton that host music. This year, it's going to be happening from August 3rd to the 6th. It's always kind of in early August. And these venues host, at least this year, it's going to be more than 200 artists. I think it was smaller before, but it keeps growing and growing and or staying about steady. So it's about 200 artists this year. It's going to be about 40 venues along this mile-long stretch of Appleton. And for the most part, all the shows are free. You don't have to pay anything. It's really just kind of a first come, first serve sort of thing. I mean, you could be a subscriber to the Mile Music Music Makers program, and that includes some perks like some priority access for certain shows, and there's some exclusive shows you can see. But you don't have to pay anything to see a ton of really great musicians. And there's a lot of great stuff from around the world. I mean, this year they've got a band called The Heavy Heavy from England. They've got White Horse is a really good folk band from Canada. But they also got a lot of great Wisconsin acts. I know Sleepy Gaucho is playing there from Milwaukee. Ben Moana, who is in the Milwaukee area, just released a really wonderful soul folk album. Really great. It's one of my favorite local releases of the year. He's going to be playing at Mile Music. And I think they've only announced 50 artists so far. At least that was the case when I wrote my story for JSOnline.com. But there's going to be, again, more than 200. So keep an eye out for more names, and it's artists from around the world and tons of artists, great artists right here in Wisconsin.
Now, you mentioned earlier one of your picks for rock this year is this Harley-Davidson Homecoming Festival. Here's a taste of one of the handful of big names on the agenda that festival. So Green Day, plus you got what, Foo Fighters, Joan Jett, the list goes on. Social Distortion was on, but I think they had to cancel out of that one. Big festival, though, Piet.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that has been happening in Milwaukee. It happens every, you know, 5 years generally. In the past, you may recall kind of the infamous Elton John surprise appearance that some was pretty polarizing. But then 5 years later, Harley made good and got Bruce Springsteen to play in 2008. That was at Veterans Park. That was the last time that Harley had a big festival in Veterans Park around its kind of Harley Davidson celebration. And they do it every kind of 5 years to celebrate the anniversary of the company. This year it's the 120th anniversary. So Veterans Park, 2008, that was the last time they did a big festival there. Flash forward to 2013, they did a festival. It was at the Summerfest grounds. The big acts that year included Toby Keith. They had Kid Rock. They had Aerosmith. And then, 5 years later after that, so that would have been I'm doing the math terribly, but 5 years ago, they didn't have a big music festival. They had a lot of events, but not really very music focused. This year, it's back to major music, and this year it's back to Veterans Park again for the first time since 2008. And you've got Green Day. Green Day played their first Milwaukee show in almost 2 decades at Summerfest in 2021. They're going to be playing one night. Foo Fighters as well. A beloved band. They were the band that played the first huge concert in Milwaukee after the pandemic shut down live music in March 2020. They're coming back. And then among the other acts that you kind of mentioned, I want to give a shout out too to some Wisconsin artists. There's Kenny Hoopla, who's a Wisconsin-raised rocker. He's got a lot of buzz behind him. He's playing as well as Abby Jean, who's kind of a soul rocker from Milwaukee. I think she's based in New York right now, but she's going to be coming back for this festival too. So it's really great to see this.
Talking to music reporter Piet Levy from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about music festivals in Wisconsin this summer and practical lessons he's learned as a frequent festival goer himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a lesson you've learned for maybe the hard way for preparing for music festivals? Do you have a favorite festival you're looking forward to here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Go on and put on that dress, see all the bad boys like. I know your daddy ain't home, so ride with me tonight. You always wind up here.
That's Zach Bryan performing this year at Summerfest. You're listening to Central Time. Piet Levy stays with us, music reporter to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, getting a preview of summer music festivals and some practical advice for first-time festival goers. You can join in with your anticipation for a festival this year, a favorite memory, or a question for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or maybe some practical advice of your own to share. Let's bring another caller on. I think about Summerfest. Peter is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Peter, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Peter?
Yeah, well, first of all, Summerfest is one of the greatest things that the world has ever known. But I wish they, I don't know if there's any word about whether they might go back to their old format of having some of the days during the week instead of just several consecutive weekends.
Oh, gotcha. Peter, Piet, changes to Summerfest there that Peter's concerned with.
Yeah, no, thanks for calling in, Peter. And that's been the case for a couple of years, and it's definitely been a divisive change to the Summerfest agenda. I mean, they basically introduced that in 2021, and they had it again in 2022. And last year, they basically said this is the way it's going to stick for, you know, the indefinite future, where instead of being the 11 days, for a while, it was 11 days with kind of a Monday off straight. It changed to 3 3-day weekends. So it's Thursdays through Saturdays across 3 weekends. This year it's June 22nd to 24th, then June 29th to July 1st, and then July 6th to 8th. It's been very divisive. And there's people who really like the old format where they can kind of go any sort of day. I know there's people in the service industry who I think don't really like this either because it cuts down on potential business on weekdays when Summerfest would be hopping. But Summerfest is stuck by this, and unfortunately, they're not going to be changing this. I mean, their argument is that they can work with 3 different weekends instead of 2 weekends, essentially, for booking, so it helps on the booking end of things. They've also tried to justify by beefing up the daytime bookings. You know, in the past, there'd be a handful of, like, national names performing on day stages maybe every day, or, you know, maybe one day with several of them. Now that the format has changed where it's, you know, every day at the festival, there's multiple kind of, you know, whether it's, you know, veteran acts, nostalgia acts, or, you know, kind of up and coming artists that are getting some buzz playing, you know, in the afternoon slots. So just trying to make the lineup more stacked every day. So yeah, there's a lot of people who don't like the way that it is, but I'm afraid to tell those people. I think it's going to be this way for a while.
Thanks for the call, Peter. Before we move on from Summerfest, Piet, any other highlights? We heard Zach Bryan there. What are some of the other shows you're looking forward to?
Yeah, Zach Bryan, I think, will be really great. That's, I mean, if there's one that's going to be kind of the one that'll be remembered this year, I think that might be the one, because he's an artist that has just got so much momentum behind him. And that show at the American Family Insurance Amphitheater on July 7th basically sold out almost instantly. American Heartbreak, his triple album last year, has been a big sensation. And he played Summerfest last year at the Miller Lite Oasis. He's kind of unknown when he was booked for that, but he had a huge crowd. And he's clearly big enough for the amphitheater and probably be playing stadiums in the near future. That's definitely a highlight. Another highlight, I think, for me personally, will be the next night. You've got Smokey Robinson, who's 82 or 83, living legend. He's playing at the U-Line Warehouse. I saw Smokey Robinson at the Miller High Life Theater in Milwaukee last year. And I was just stunned by how great that show was, how energetic he was, how amazing his voice sounded. It was just a stunning, like, honestly privilege and honor to see him perform. And I'm really floored that he's playing at Summerfest on one of the quote free stages, on the ground stages. So anyone with a general admission ticket can see this legend. And I think you really owe it to yourself to see him. He's still so good in concert. That's definitely a highlight. Another highlight too I want to shout out is there's a Mexican rapper named Santa Fe Clan who's going to be performing on June 24th at the Miller Lite Oasis. I think that's really noteworthy too, because, you know, Summerfest in the years past, they've had kind of hit and miss years with hip hop. Sometimes they're really got some great cutting edge artists. Sometimes it's artists kind of past their prime, or it's a little bit boring. And then in terms of Latin music, you know, even though Latin music has been really surging in popularity across the last decade or so, you know, the Latin bookings at Summerfest have been kind of behind the times and behind that curve. Pretty far back behind that curve. So to see them book Santa Fe Clan, who is a fast rising Mexican rapper who embraces the sounds of cumbia into his sound. He's done something really novel with that, and he's doing his first arena tour. But he's also doing a ground stage. So with just a general admission ticket, you can see this artist who's playing arenas around the country at Summerfest. And it's great to see Summerfest book a Latin artist who's on a fast ascent. That's really cool to see that kind of, you know, that novel cutting edge booking.
We're on another caller now. Stan is with us in De Pere. Stan, hi.
Yeah, hey. The first concert of the summer festival of the series every year is Celebrate De Pere, which just got over. It's every Memorial weekend, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Memorial weekend. It's the biggest veterans celebration in the state. But we just had it, and there was 30,000 people there. Over 3 days. On Sunday, they had 18,000 people there to see the glam band, to see the former lead singer of the Bodines, and it's live music on two stages from 11:30 in the morning to 11:30 at night, both days, and then Monday as well. And it's only $5 for the whole day to see music on two stages. So if your guest hasn't been there, I strongly recommend it. Occasionally, they have big headliners, you know, like the Starship or Night Ranger and people like that. It's a lot of 80s and 90s and a lot of country music as well.
Stan, thanks a lot for the call. Get that on our calendar for next Memorial Day. Talking to Piet Levy from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, previewing summer music festival season and getting some practical advice. Let's get back to the practical side of things, Piet. If that ding wasn't us losing you, no, we still got you. Now, there's always the question, you know, do I dance? Do I stand? How much do I muscle into getting into a good spot? Can you share some crowd etiquette with us at a music festival?
Yeah, sure. I mean, generally what I generally do is I kind of follow the way of the crowd. That's how I go about it. I mean, if there's people, you know, if there's people sitting behind me and people are sitting in front of me, I generally tend to sit. But you know, I mean, if you want to dance, dance too. I mean, you've got to kind of do what you want to do. I think trying not to muscle ahead of people is definitely that's frowned upon. You probably shouldn't do that. I do remember one funny Summerfest story where this was years ago. I was there with my wife and her family, and we had our dinner. We were gonna go see Pink. This is before she was playing the amphitheater. We got a picnic table. We were really excited. We had a great spot to see her. And then this person who seemed like they were partying a little too hard, kind of just proceeded to stand on the picnic table and dance during the show, like right around our, like, you know, Miss Kitty's Diner chicken tenders. So we could see like her feet kind of stomping around our food. And I remember asking her very politely, "Do you mind getting down while we have our dinner?"
I am getting down.
She kind of, she was getting down, but she did not want to get down off the table. She had some very choice words.
Huh.
And, you know, that was that, you know, so don't do that.
Keep please my feet out of other people's chicken.
Please keep your feet out of people's chicken. Please try not to drink too hard, you know, and be respectful of others. Please, please, please.
And then I wanted to ask about, you know, people with mobility needs who still want to get out and enjoy a show. Do festivals often offer accommodations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they should, and a lot of them do. I know that there's, you know, there's ADA seating for sure at Summerfest, and generally they seem to be, they, like, for instance, in the amphitheater, they've increased the ADA seating capacities there, which is great. They've had, they've added elevators there, which I don't know if they were there before with the revamped amphitheater that opened in 2021. I mean, that's absolutely crucial and important. So I know at Summerfest for sure there is definitely improved ADA. I would be shocked if Harley did not have that, for instance, even though it's kind of like a one-time sort of festival situation. But that's definitely something that, you know, festival organizers generally are cognizant of. And you know, I think as with any festival goer, just give yourself plenty of time to get there to kind of sort out some things and make sure you can get what you need. But generally, yes, I've seen that and haven't heard a ton of complaints, at least when covering Summerfest, which is what the festival I cover the most.
Piet, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Piet Levy is a music reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us with a preview of Wisconsin's many summer music festivals and to share some advice on how to make the most of them. Hey, get more of his recommendations. He's got a big piece at jsonline.com. Previewing a bunch of festivals, a lot of big country festivals coming to the state, some hip-hop, some metal, all genres, and some that combine lots of different genres. That's at jsonline.com. Coming up, former President Trump appeared in a federal court today as a defendant in a case surrounding the possession of classified government documents and obstructing the investigation of those documents. We'll check out the case against Donald Trump. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, professional golf in the U.S. is coming under heavy criticism for an announced merger with a competing golf league backed by Saudi Arabian money. A Marquette sports law professor will take us through the legal and ethical controversies surrounding the change. Now, Donald Trump last week became the first ever former or sitting president to face federal criminal charges over his alleged misuse of federal documents and obstruction of an investigation into those documents. Trump made his first appearance in the case in a Miami courtroom earlier today. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this first criminal case against an American president? How do you feel about federal officials' investigation into Trump's withholding of classified documents? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. David Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
Can you bring us through the process that led up to these indictments, the appointment of a special counsel, the grand jury? What got us here?
What got us here was a discovery sometime after Donald Trump left office, when it was discovered that there were documents at the Mar-a-Lago that potentially needed to be returned. At least at that stage, there were concerns about whether classified or top secret materials. And the Justice Department contacted Donald Trump, contacted his attorneys and said, "We believe there are some documents there that you're no longer entitled to hold, or they're in an unsecured place." And that really was the start of a back and forth conversation, at least according to the criminal indictment that we had filed against Donald Trump, that really starts back in 2021, that obviously has, at least for now, culminated in the indictment and the arraignment today. But what appears to have happened over about a two-year period is that there were numerous requests, allegedly requests to Donald Trump and his attorneys for certain documents. At some point, there was Denial that there were any documents. At some point, some documents were returned. There was eventually a search warrant of the Mar-a-Lago to try to retrieve others. So this has been part of a ongoing, let us say, investigation and dialogue, again, of which really starts up not too far after he had left office, and really surrounds both the fact that, as the allegations are, that he's not authorized to have these documents, and these documents, which in some cases are sensitive or top secret materials, are in an unsecured location, unapproved by the Defense and Justice Department.
Let's talk about whether Trump was supposed to have these documents. I want to give a listen to former Trump administration Attorney General Bill Barr speaking about that on Fox News back on Sunday.
He was totally wrong that he had the right to have those documents. Those documents are among the most sensitive secrets that the country has. They have to be in the custody of the archivist. He had no right to maintain them and retain them. And he kept them in a way at Mar-a-Lago that anyone who really cares about national security, their stomach would churn at it.
Can you talk about what former Attorney General Barr had to say there? These things aren't supposed to be out of federal custody, in effect.
You're absolutely correct. Is that while as President of the United States, Donald Trump was entitled to see these documents, he may have even been entitled to declassify them, although there's some debate, you know, on that issue, but we won't get into that here. But he had access to them. But once you leave office, you no longer are entitled to these government documents. Personal papers, perhaps, yes. But government documents, no, especially documents that are classified as, again, confidential, secret, top secret. But it certainly doesn't matter. These are the property of the United States government. So that's one broad issue. The second broad issue is about where they were kept. This is what Attorney General Barr was talking about, is the sense that once If these are materials that are classified or confidential, they have to be stored in an appropriate location that is secure against anybody just sort of walking in, grabbing them, seeing them. One of the worst nightmares that, let us say, the Defense Department can have is not knowing who has seen perhaps battle plans or who has seen top secret information. In effect, not knowing who knows what that we don't know about. And so that's what Barr is talking about here. It's both, not only was the president, as an ex-president, no longer entitled to have these documents, but two, even if, just for the sake of argument, even if he were entitled to do so, he had them in an unsecure, unapproved location at the Mar-a-Lago.
Since this first became a story, we had former Vice President Pence reveal that he had some documents he wasn't supposed to. He volunteered that info, returned them. Now President Biden, from his term as vice president, also had some. He volunteered that info, brought in people for a search. There have been questions about, okay, why is Donald Trump being indicted, not those two? And one key thing here seems to be the word willfully in the relevant law. Do you have these documents on purpose? Are you concealing them from the federal government? Can you compare and contrast the Trump case versus the Biden and Pence cases?
Sure. For first, let's just start with a basic premise here, that to convict somebody of a crime, you not only have to show factually they did something, but you have to show intent. You have to show perhaps willful or deliberate, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of a general preposition of American law. But specifically, let's look at one of the laws he's being charged with, which is part of the Espionage Act, and it's the willful retention of national defense information. And the emphasis is upon willful here, because unlike Biden, unlike Pence, when it was discovered that they had the material, by accident they had this, they fully cooperated with the FBI. They turned over materials. They did not impede in any way the investigation or the return of the materials. The criminal indictment against Donald Trump basically says this is willful, also pointing to the fact, which is why there's also charges of conspiracy to obstruct justice. They're showing that what? That he made a choice to do so. And additionally, the law says not only do you have to make a willful choice, but it's also documents in a unsecure, unapproved location. And many of us have seen those pictures in the last few days of what boxes stacked up, and was it like bathrooms and stuff like that. But that's a really important distinction to understand here. It's about the intention. And if, again, if the criminal complaint is correct in terms of them laying out at least preliminarily some of the evidence, it's clear that Donald Trump, again, according to the indictment, knew that he was not supposed to have these documents. And in fact, some of the most damning evidence against him is from his former attorneys, who, where he tried to get him to, again, allegedly to lie or to deny there were documents or say there was no more. So that's a critical difference, what he did in terms of once the documents were discovered.
Talking to David Schultz with Hamline University and the University of Minnesota Law School, looking at the indictments against former President Donald Trump in this federal case over executive branch documents. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A former President Trump, David, has said, hey, this is political. This is a Democratic administration targeting a Republican predecessor and future Republican competitor in the next election, potentially. How do you see the chain of command? Is it insulated enough from political interference to defend against charges from the former president and supporters in Congress?
Two responses to that. First, that this was insulated, where apparently Joe Biden had no involvement in this. This was what? Something decided by the Justice Department, but more importantly, by careerists who are in the Justice Department who are prosecutors. So this was fairly insulated. But second, if this had been anybody else except for an ex-president who had material such as this, perhaps maybe a Julian Assange or somebody else, this would be treated equally as seriously in terms of the fact that what? We have secret information, documents about U.S. security, about defense policy, out and disclosed by unauthorized persons in an unauthorized locations. And again, we've seen over the last few years stories about that. Again, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning. We have a recent story also, I'm forgetting the name of the person off the top of my head, who was charged with disclosure of military secrets. So ordinary people would be treated just as harshly as this.
Talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University of Law at the University of Minnesota, looking at the federal indictment of former President Trump over the alleged willful possession of classified documents and alleged obstruction of the investigation into those documents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the charges against the former president? What questions do you have? What do you hope comes out of this? What do you fear comes out of this? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with University of Minnesota Law Professor David Schultz about the federal indictments of former President Donald Trump over his handling of secret documents. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions you have about the process here, the charges against the former president, what happens next, and what do you think about these indictments? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. David, we had the former president appear in this federal court in Miami today, pleading not guilty to the charges. What happens next?
Well, what happens next at this point is a little bit of what was happening today. Besides the plea at this point, there was probably some, again, we didn't have a lot of information about what happened in court. There was probably some original scheduling orders. And what I mean by scheduling orders is that the judge and the attorneys have to agree to a variety of different things at this point, agree to things like depositions, exchanging of evidence, timelines on a whole bunch of different things. But what we can probably look forward to seeing over the next few weeks will be the Trump attorneys trying to get the charges dismissed, maybe trying to get some evidence thrown out. And then we should be thinking about very shortly, probably a trial date is going to be set. And the federal prosecutors would like to have a sooner as opposed to a later prosecution or a trial date. Perhaps Trump might want to push it out, maybe push it out till after the election. But assuming for the sake of argument, the trial occurs when I think it's going to occur. And I say, I think, we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. It would be approximately, let's say, 12, 13 months out. If my counting is correct at this point, we could very well see this trial take place sometime in July or August of 2024, maybe a little bit later, which would put us at the tail end of the primaries around the time of the Republican convention, or depending on exactly the location of time, maybe as the general election is starting at this point. So this is going to be a trial that's going to be dead center into the 2024 presidential election cycle.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Milwaukee. Jeff, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Jeff?
Yes, I was curious. I look at some of my friends who are Trump supporters, and they make the claim that, well, this is a two-tiered system of justice. To be fair, if you look at the former case with Secretary Hillary Clinton, she was in possession of government documents, of which were destroyed with, what I believe, was a bleach bit software to, in effort to clean the servers, and destruction of government property in the forms of BlackBerries and the cell phones with those government documents on them. I mean, he has a point. Is there a two-tiered system of justice?
Jeff, thanks for the call. David, I brought up the Pence and Biden examples as a little closer. These are all items that were on servers. The Hillary Clinton case, though, our caller wondering why wasn't she ultimately charged in that?
Well, there does seem to be evidence that she was cooperating, that again, it wasn't in the same kind of, let's say, willful way that Donald Trump is being charged. And for her, I will concede and say there were some problems there. There were some problems at the end of the day in terms of questions that may have never been resolved. However, having said that, Even if she should have been charged but was not, the fact of the matter is that the Justice Department here has evidence of what they believe is a crime and are prosecuting in this case. And you can't really sort of make the argument and say other people weren't prosecuted for doing something wrong, and therefore I shouldn't be prosecuted.
Thanks for the call. Carly joins us now in Kewaunee. Carly, hello.
Hi, hello.
What did you want to bring up, Carly?
Well, kind of going off of what Jeff was just saying, but, when Trump says that this is all, a conspiracy and we're out to get him, and I have people that, and then obviously the people that support him want to repeat that, and they believe it, and they think that this is all just a witch hunt and blah, blah, blah. But there's the whole justice system. How do you explain that means that everyone who put together the indictments and got the jury and the judges and all the people, do they imagine them sitting around going, yes, we're all on the same page. We'd like to take him down, even though this is wrong. How can we explain to say that there is literal evidence? And if people, we've seen how up in arms people got about her emails, you would think people would have tried to get her an indictment. There's probably people that tried to get her indicted and they couldn't because there was no evidence to do so.
Carly, thanks a lot for the call. I think Carly getting David to confidence in the system that led to these indictments.
I think she makes a good point here, but again, I'll come back and make the argument and say that if we read the criminal complaint, if we read what appears to be the evidence right now, Trump knew he was not supposed to be in possession of these documents, obstructed the FBI and the Justice Department effort to do an investigation, obstructed them in terms of trying to get documents returned. They had to get a search warrant to go get these documents, even after he said they didn't exist. And if you look at, again, the criminal indictment, it appears that he tried to get his attorneys to lie about all of this stuff. Granted, we have a presumption of innocence until proven guilty. But the fact that there seems to be What? The existence that he did have documents that he was not entitled to possess. He had documents in a location that was not authorized to hold those documents. We do have evidence of an underlying crime here that eventually a jury is going to have to decide if he's guilty. But that's how I think the Justice Department would respond, is to say it's not a witch hunt. There is a basis. Had the president or ex-president returned all these documents, had he not done all these different things, we wouldn't have an indictment now. The Justice Department's argument would be to say that Trump brought these problems on himself, much in the same way that Attorney General Barr made those comments, I think, this past Sunday on national television.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Marianne now in Kirtle. Marianne, hi.
Hi. I just have one comment. I read the entire indictment, and I suggest that everybody do the same, first of all. Second of all, three lawyers, all Trump lawyers, and two employees of Donald Trump rolled on him. And basically, he was playing hide-and-go-seek with 80 boxes of documents that were everything from needing a special place to even view them all the way down to confidential. So how dare he plead not guilty? And that's my comment.
Marianne, thanks for the call. And yeah, reading the indictment, David, there's a lot of movement of these documents, sometimes concealed, mm-hmm. according to the indictment, concealed from some of Trump's own lawyers before they got a look at them. How important do you think that series of evidence of that hide and seek, as Marianne says, will be in this case?
I think it's going to be very critical. I think also what's going to be critical is going to be the potential testimony of his former attorneys, where there appears to be notes and conversations where he's telling them at some point, what if we just say that no documents exist, or tell them we've returned them all and so forth like that. And that's going to be important, because that information, his conversations with his attorneys, are going to be allowed into court, or potentially allowed into court. And that becomes some of the strongest evidence, as well as the fact, as the caller pointed out, that documents were moved around in what appears to be an evidence to either obstruct justice or hide the documents from the FBI or the Justice Department.
Thanks for that call. In our last minute and a half or so, David, the judge who will preside over this case, at least currently planned Judge Eileen Cannon, a Trump appointee, which doesn't always mean much. She was viewed as being sympathetic to the former president in early stages of this investigation. Your thoughts on Judge Cannon and this case?
Well, it may be at least initially good for the Justice Department to have perhaps a Trump appointee, because it's going to be a little bit harder for Donald Trump to claim she's biased, that she is out to get him, when he appointed her and in an earlier ruling, she was ruling in his favor. Now, how this plays out going down the line, I don't know, because again, we know that she was overturned, by a higher level of courts on some other issues down the line here. But it's going to be interesting to see how a Trump appointee handles this case going forward. I'm not expecting at this point to see either side ask her to recuse herself, take herself off the case. But I wouldn't rule that out as a possibility down the line, but I think it's a remote one.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure, and thank you for the callers.
That's David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University and professor of law at the University of Minnesota. He joined us for a look at the federal charges against former President Trump over his possession of classified documents. Trump appeared in a federal court in Miami earlier today, kicking off this process. You can keep sharing your thoughts and follow the story online on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and we'll have reporting from our colleagues at NPR online at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, this will be fun. It's rhubarb season. Get some advice on cooking and baking with the seasonal favorite. I've got a rhubarb plant planted by previous owner at my house. It is very productive. I've got a bunch already in the freezer. Looking for more advice on what to do with it. Now, if you have a favorite rhubarb recipe, get that conversation started right now. email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org with your rhubarb advice, recipes, or questions. Then join the conversation with Kate and her guest. That's tomorrow morning at 7. Check it out here on the Ideas Network. If you're a nerd of a certain age, like me, you may have fond memories of the first video game console system you ever used. For me, that was the Atari 2600 with those cartridges that chunked into the system. Lots of consoles have come and gone since then. They stopped making official games for the 2600 back in 1990. But if you're still hanging on to your old console, good news, Atari is releasing a new game with one version on a cartridge made for the 40-year-old machines. As reported at Engadget, the new game is Mr. Run and Jump, and it's going to be released on a number of platforms, including Atari 2600 cartridge. Company says they're doing that in order to highlight, quote, the enduring capabilities of the 2600 hardware, even four decades after its initial release. Plus, I'm guessing they get some publicity for their new game. My old Atari, lost to the ages. I'm not going to hustle out to find one that still works. Got a lot of memories of Space Invaders, Pitfall, and more. It's an older system, but it checks out. This is Central Time.